Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. Today on our Capitol Report, we'll have the latest on efforts to reunite migrant children separated from their parents. In local news, hear how you can report storm damage to the county to help with an emergency declaration and why help is needed to help an exotic animal rescue facility in Alpine devastated by the storms. Health officials are warning parents about a rise in Kawasaki disease, and we'll have details. On Green Scene, hear about a proposed new Campo Wind project and substation. We'll also have coverage of efforts by conservatives to launch a convention of states to amend the Constitution. On People Power, hear about an East County nonprofit that served up hot meals and valentines for the homeless. A Potrero woman has died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Hear how to protect your family from this deadly threat on today's show. On People Power, learn about a horse rescue in Descanso. Then we'll have news about a Border Patrol chase that ended in a rollover crash in Boulevard. And we'll take you on the road to the historic Campo Stone store, the site of a notorious gunfight. From Public News Service, we'll have some national news headlines, including the latest on the North Korea nuclear threat. Plus, hear about the proposed Green New Deal and new efforts to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act. Later, we'll have two best of East County favorites, a Sounds of History interview with Dick Pennick at the Southern Pacific Railway Museum in Campo, and a Wildest Jobs interview with Lakeside's Rodeo Clown. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital.
Following revelations that the Trump administration failed to inform a federal judge that it began separating migrant children from their parents back in 2017, a federal judge in San Diego has sent strong signals on Thursday that he's prepared to expand his June 2018 reunification order to mandate reunions of more families who came to the U.S. seeking freedom from persecution. Judge Dana Sabraw's original order required unification only of children who were in government custody at the time, taken from migrant parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. But Thursday, Judge Sabraw made clear no one but a few in the government knew that these separations had been going on 9 or 10 months before, and that hundreds, if not thousands, were being separated. And, he added, the court didn't know that, and plaintiff didn't know that, and I don't think government counsel knew that. The comments came in a case filed by the American Civil Liberties Union seeking reunification of separated migrant families. One option could be for Sabraw to allow ACLU pro bono attorneys and volunteers to help track down all of the children and families who were separated, as they have already done to find most of the 2,800 families in the original lawsuit. We are prepared no matter how big the burden is, says ACLU attorney Lee Gelernt, USA Today reports. But Gelernt also called for officials from Homeland Security and the Health and Human Services Department to be mandated to cooperate, since they hold information on the traumatized families. But Department of Justice lawyer Scott Stewart argued that it would be too burdensome to force the federal government to find all of those separated children and their parents. He claimed such a mandate would, quote, blow the case into some other galaxy. Meanwhile, House Democrats are preparing to issue subpoenas to the Trump administration for documents related to the migrant family separation policy. Politico reports that the House Oversight Committee will vote Tuesday to authorize subpoenas for the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, and Health and Human Services. The vote is expected to be approved by the committee's Democratic majority over objections raised by Republicans. At least two more congressional committees, the Homeland Security Committee and House Appropriations Committee, may also be readying investigations into the family separation policy, Politico reports. Many of these families arrived as refugees claiming asylum, which under international law should provide them with protection and humane treatment pending their asylum hearings. But the Trump administration has repeatedly defied international law to protect rights of asylum seekers. The president declared an emergency last week in an effort to build a border wall that Congress has refused to fund, claiming migrant caravans constitute an emergency, and that is also headed for the courts. The American Psychological Association has warned of severe psychological trauma to children separated forcibly from their parents and contends that the real crisis is a mental health crisis at the border. Dr. Carola Suarez Orozco, a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles, conducted research that was cited by the American Psychological Association in a letter sent to President Trump objecting to the family separation policy. She concludes, many immigrants are leaving traumatic situations in their home countries, and their journeys to get here are extremely arduous and inflict more trauma. To separate children from their parents inflicts further trauma. This is cruel to children and hugely disruptive to their sense of safety and well-being. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
If your property sustained damage during the storms that struck our region the week of Valentine's Day, the county would like your help in estimating the cost for our region. The cold winter storms brought record-setting rainfall, flooding, and high winds to San Diego County. If your property or small business was damaged, the County Office of Emergency Services is asking you to complete a short damage survey form. The information gathered from the surveys will be used to estimate total damages countywide and determine if enough damage occurred to qualify the region for state or federal disaster recovery assistance, such as low-interest disaster loans from the Small Business Administration for those who are uninsured or underinsured. Completing the form does not guarantee the property owner will be eligible to receive disaster assistance. For more information or to fill out the damage survey form, you can visit sdrecovery.com or email the Office of Emergency Services at oes@sdcounty.ca.gov. That's oes@sdcounty.ca.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fisteer.
The recent storms wreaked havoc at lions, tigers, and bears, a sanctuary for rescued exotic animals in Alpine. Fortunately, all of the animals are safe, but Bobby Brink, founder of Lions, Tigers, and Bears, sent photos of the damage to supporters in an email stating that the powerful storm system left a huge mess in its wake. Every habitat pool has flooded and water from the pools have been mixed with mud, clogging pool filters and pumps. The equipment can't be used without damage from the heavy sediment levels. A barn which houses a surgery room, gift shop, office, and volunteer area are also flooded, and muddy rivers have carved channels across the property. Major cleanup work is needed. According to Brink, heavy equipment must be rented to regrade the land and remove excess mud. In addition, piping must be purchased, excavator and installer must be hired to place piping underground across the property to help drain out the buildup of floodwaters. Donations are needed to help the licensed nonprofit animal sanctuary whose residents include lions, tigers, bears, a leopard, mountain lion, bobcat, and other species. If you wish to help, you can visit liontigersandbears.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Danita Jinks.
This is Jonathan Getz with a health alert. San Diego County health officials are warning parents about an increase in Kawasaki disease. 16 children locally have been diagnosed with the disease this year, and more cases may occur through March due to the wet, cool weather. Kawasaki disease affects mostly children under age 5. The symptoms include fever, rash, swelling of the hands and feet, bloodshot eyes, swollen lymph glands at the neck, and red mouth, lips, and throat. Peeling of the fingers and toes occurs in many patients after the fever has subsided. Parents should take children with these symptoms to a medical provider for an evaluation. If left untreated, roughly a quarter of the children with Kawasaki disease develop coronary artery aneurysms, balloon-like bulges of heart vessels that can cause heart attacks, congestive heart failure, or sudden death. Fortunately, IV treatments can help reduce coronary inflammation and save lives if provided during the early days of the illness. Testing can also detect whether heart damage has occurred, and surgery or other treatments may be recommended. Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health officer, says Kawasaki disease is often confused with more common illnesses, so the county is alerting physicians and parents to help raise awareness. Nationwide, fewer than 6,000 children a year in the U.S. are estimated to have Kawasaki disease. But in San Diego, a sharp increase in cases has health professionals concerned. The Kawasaki Disease Research Center at Rady's Children's Hospital, San Diego, and UC San Diego School of Medicine alerted the county to the fact that twice as many San Diego children had been diagnosed with Kawasaki disease so far this year compared to prior years. That's part of a trend in increased Kawasaki disease cases locally in recent years. In San Diego, during the 1990s, about 10 out of 100,000 children under age 5 had the disease. But during the decade from 2006 to 2015, the rate jumped to more than 25 out of 100,000 children. Doctors are not required to report the disease to local health departments in California, but it is the most common acquired heart disease in children. The causes of Kawasaki disease are unknown. However, researchers at UC San Diego School of Medicine, Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and international collaborators have studied climate patterns and found that environmental triggers influenced by climate might be responsible for the increase in cases. Genetic predisposition also plays a role, with Asian Pacific Islanders having an increased risk compared to other races or ethnicities. Dr. Jane Burns, a pediatrician at Rady Children's Hospital and director of the Kawasaki Disease Research Center, wants doctors to be especially vigilant during wet, cool weather. She adds, the climate patterns that are associated with increased numbers of children diagnosed have occurred more frequently here so far this year. You can learn more by visiting the website for the Kawasaki Disease Research Center at UC San Diego.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Danita Jinks with the Green Scene Report. A proposed new Campo wind farm would cover most of the Campo Indian Reservation with 60 new wind turbines. Each 4-megawatt turbine would be 100 to 200 feet taller than the 25 existing Kumeyaay wind turbines or the 57 Thule wind project turbines already in the area. A new electric substation and power lines are also planned in conjunction with the project. The county plans to hold a scoping meeting on February 28th at 6 p.m. at the Boulevard Fire Station regarding TerraGen's Boulder Brush Gen Tri and substation facilities, which are proposed on private land to support the Campo Wind Project. Prior wind projects in the vicinity have generated complaints from some residents over noise, effort sound, flashing lights, health concerns, fire dangers, loss of views and rural character, and harm to raptors and other wildlife. Arguments for the project include producing renewable energy to combat climate change and providing revenues for the Campo Indian tribe. The public is encouraged to come voice your views as part of the official public input process at the February 20th county meeting. In addition, the project will be on the March 7th agenda for the Boulevard Planning Group. You can also submit comments in writing to the county by March 18th if you can't attend one of these meetings. You can find links for more information on our website at www.eastcountymagazine.org in our Green Scene section.
The U.S. Constitution grants states the power to call a convention of states to propose amendments to the federal Constitution. To do so would require that 34 states agree to call a convention, and it would take 38 states to ratify any proposed amendments. A national movement has begun among conservatives seeking to convene such a convention, with local Republican Assemblyman Randy Vopel the latest voice to support the idea. Local Convention of States Project delegates met with Vopel on February 8th, and next up, plan a meeting with State Senator Brian Jones, says Barry Trehe of Lakeside, a member of the group. Spokesman Fred Yerrick says the group believes a convention is necessary to rein in a federal government that has overstepped its bounds. He says, we can't vote our way out of the mess Washington, D.C. has made. We have a runaway bureaucracy, bloated government, massive deficits, and well over $100 trillion in unfunded liabilities. He contends that the framers of the Constitution foresaw that government could grow to be oppressive and included Article 5 to give states a way to propose constitutional amendments that bypass Congress. It's never been done that way in our nation's history. All prior amendments were first approved by Congress before being ratified by states. The website conventionofstates.com states that the current effort seeks to convene a convention that would be limited to allowing states to discuss amendments that, quote, limit the power and jurisdiction of the federal government, impose fiscal restraints, and place term limits on federal offices. The site claims that since the project's launch in 2013, it has gained over 3 million supporters, including petition gatherers in every congressional district. Prominent backers include Republican Senators Rand Paul and Marco Rubio, former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, and ex-Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Conservatives aren't the only ones to propose a convention of states. Some liberal groups have also sought one, though for far different reasons. For example, Wolfpack, a liberal organization, has called for a convention of states to reform campaign finance laws and rein in dark money and corporate donations in the wake of the Citizens United decision by the Supreme Court. But some experts warn that a convention of states could be a Pandora's box that might result in unintended consequences. In an editorial published in The Hill, a newspaper serving the Capital area in Washington, D.C., Georgetown Law School professor David Super states, calling an Article 5 convention is reckless, especially at this divisive moment in our nation's political history. Super, who also served as general counsel for the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, warns that nothing in the Constitution authorizes Congress, state legislatures, or anyone else to limit the agenda of an Article 5 convention. Plus, the Supreme Court has made clear that the process of amending the Constitution is a political question in which the courts would not intervene. Once the delegates convene, they are answerable only to themselves, he says, adding that the Constitution does not give states power to constrain their delegates or dictate how they should vote. The legal scholar advises that in foreseeing the possible outcome of a convention to alter the Constitution, we can learn from the past. He concludes, the product that emerges from an Article 5 convention could be radically different from what those asking it to be called may have envisioned, just as the Philadelphia Convention of 1787 departed sharply from its mandate to propose amendments to the Article of Confederation. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's backcountry.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is John Fisteer with a People Power report. The McAllister Institute, a nonprofit organization based in East County, showed some love for homeless people in San Diego just in time for Valentine's Day. On February 13th, clients from McAllister's group Home East, a short-term residential treatment home for teens funded by the county, distributed Valentine's Day cards to homeless people at the First Presbyterian Church in San Diego to show kindness and compassion. The cards were distributed along with a hot meal to around 150 homeless individuals, served up by youths from McAllister Institute's Group Home Program. McAllister Institute also provides services such as substance abuse treatment, mental health counseling, life skills education, and vocational training to people in need, even if they lack the ability to pay.
A Potrero woman, 38-year-old Alejandra Alejandre, has died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Two other family members, a man and a child, were taken to a trauma center last Wednesday with symptoms of carbon monoxide toxicity, including nausea and lightheadedness. According to the county medical examiner, the woman was found unresponsive in her bed and a family member called 911. Paramedics provided CPR but were unable to revive her. She was declared dead at the scene. CAL FIRE firefighters tested the air and found elevated levels of the gas, which is colorless and odorless. At high levels, it can cause brain damage or death. The source of the carbon monoxide poisoning is under investigation. However, in winter months, a malfunctioning heater is often responsible for such tragedies. Some past carbon monoxide poisonings have occurred when people used devices meant for outdoor use to heat their home or cook, such as a hibachi or camp stove. SDG&E will provide residents with a free inspection before you light the pilot light on a gas heater during fall or winter months. A carbon monoxide detector, or several in a larger home, can save lives by providing early warning. Be sure to change batteries each year on all carbon monoxide detectors in your home to keep you and your family safe from carbon monoxide poisoning. Reporting for East County Magazine in Potrero, this is Jonathan Getz.
Multiple county agencies came to the rescue of a horse last week in Descanso. A woman was riding her horse along the Harvey Moore Trail when the horse and rider tumbled down a slippery, muddy slope. The woman was not hurt, but the horse became stuck in the mud on its back. The Sheriff's Department, Cal Fire, San Diego Fire Authority, County Animal Services, and an equine veterinarian were all called in to help rescue the horse. The agencies and the owner worked together to fashion a series of rope. Several hours after the fall, they managed to ride her horse. Fortunately, the animal then walked out of the ravine on its own with only minor scratches. County Animal Services Director Daniel DeSosa says, "When people and animals are in need of assistance, the community will always come together to provide this assistance." This was epitomized in this rescue of the horse, with the various agencies working side by side to extricate the horse from its predicament. Reporting for East County Magazine in Descanso, this is Danita Jinks.
A Border Patrol pursuit in Boulevard last week resulted in a rollover crash that injured five people. A Mazda on McCain Valley Road near Old Highway 80 failed to stop for a Border Patrol vehicle with flashing lights and a siren regarding possible immigration violations. A chase ensued that ended when the driver lost control in a dip on Shasta Way near Highway 94, striking a steel fence and a utility pole. The Mazda rolled over but came to rest on its wheels, says Officer Travis Garrow with the CHP. The driver, a 23-year-old woman from San Diego, had only minor injuries and was transported to Sharp Memorial Hospital and taken into custody by the Border Patrol. Four men, aged 24 through 39, were lying down in the back passenger compartment without seat belts. They sustained mild to moderate injuries. Two were taken by ambulance to Sharp Memorial. Two others refused medical aid and were taken into custody by the Border Patrol. Drugs and alcohol are not believed to be factors in the collision. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is John Fistier.
Next up from County News Service, we're going to be hearing from Larry Johnson out at the old Campo Stone Store, one of East County's most unique and colorful historical landmarks.
If you're ever on Highway 94, about an hour east of San Diego, you might see this unique building.
Welcome to Historic Campo and the Gaskell Brothers Stone Store Museum.
The Gaskell Brothers built a fortress-like stone store in 1885. Previously, it was a wooden structure, the site of a famous shootout.
A group of bandits had been raiding down the coast of California, so gunfire started. And there was a big shootout. The guy that they had shot on the floor, one of the Gaskell brothers, didn't kill him. He jumped up, grabbed a shotgun, went out and shot people. And so they were shooting dead blank range around. And both Gaskell brothers were wounded. The locals were afraid of another raid. They couldn't get the military up here to guard and protect them. So they thought they needed a substantial building. So that's why they decided to build a building as thick as this and as strong as this. If you take a look around, if you come in, you'll see that the walls down here are about 4 foot thick. It's from stone that was quarried here on site by hand with hammer and drill and no backhoes or heavy lifting objects. It was manpower. It served as a store from 1885 until about 1927.
No longer a store, this building is now a museum, thanks to County Parks and the Mountain Empire Historical Society. Today, the store reflects the early life of the town of Campo.
When the Historical Society began, they tried to make it look a lot like it did in 1899, or when it was a store functioning to serve the local public. So they have gathered some of the food stuff, the tobaccos, the medical supplies, the ropes, the cans, anything that the ranchers needed. If they didn't have it, you didn't need it.
The building is filled with photos, books, artifacts from the Kumeyaay Indians who occupied the region prior to the settlers, and other rare items.
These shackles were found locally about 3 miles from here on a ranch in about 1885. A person who's bought the ranch found in the well the skeleton. On the skeleton, on the legs, were these shackles. They didn't know who the body was or who the skeleton was. It's still a mystery today. One of the interesting things about these shackles is they're blacksmith made. There's no lock to them. Once they were on, they were meant to stay.
Upstairs is an impressive exhibit dedicated to Campo's military history, including Camp Lockett.
Camp Lockett was started before the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. I guess the military was anticipating that there was going to be a war, and they needed another base here, and they needed a base in this area because of the railroad, which was a key supply line. We had a long exposed border, and one of the things they were afraid of was that if the Japanese came into the war, they might invade Mexico and come into San Diego. So this was sort of a critical point, and so they started building Camp Lockett.
The 10th Cavalry is one you may have heard of.
The famed Buffalo Soldiers, white officers and an African-American enlisted troops. And they were stationed here, and they were guarding tunnels and railroad and the border. Very tough, very good soldiers.
The museum is open on weekends, making for a nice day trip to learn about our local pioneers.
They were entrepreneurs, every one of them. They were constantly trying to figure out how to make the best of what they had and where they were, and to make a living and to leave history and substantial items behind them so that descendants would have something to live and work on and hopefully try and take care of.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's backcountry.
The Public News Service Daily Newscast for Monday, February the 25th, 2019. I'm Mike Clifford. Administration officials confronted on the reality of the North Korea nuclear threat. Also on the Monday rundown, Congress questions the cancellation of a surface mine study, plus a victory for New Yorkers with vision disabilities. First, our top story, just days before President Trump is set to meet for a second time with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. USA Today reports Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was confronted about a claim the president made after the first summit. Pompeo, while appearing on CNN's Sunday Morning, was asked whether North Korea was considered a nuclear threat to the U.S. Yes, he told Jake Tapper, the host, but the president says he doesn't, Tapper replied. Pompeo shot back, that's not what he said, and then CNN's Tapper said he tweeted there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. Meantime, Democrats are probing the reasons why a National Academy of Sciences study on the health effects of surface coal mining in central Appalachia was canceled. Our Nadia Ramlagan has more.
The U.S. Interior Department halted the study in 2017, calling it a cost-saving measure. But Representatives Raul Grijalva from Arizona and Alan Lowenthal from California have asked the department to turn over all documents related to the cancellation, including any conversations between interior officials and coal companies or industry groups. Aaron Haynes, an epidemiology professor at the University of Kentucky, says it's still not clear what the health risks are for people in communities near surface mines.
This area has lacked, I think, scientific attention, and it's highly warranted and overdue.
The House Committee on Natural Resources wants Acting Interior Secretary David Bernhardt to release all documents and communications related to the surface mining study to the committee by March 15th.
Last summer, surface mines in Kentucky produced more than 2 million tons of coal. That's a 15% decrease from 2017. And finally, Andrea Sears reports New Yorkers with vision disabilities will soon be able to navigate State Board of Elections and Department of Motor Vehicles websites.
Almost 400,000 New Yorkers have visual disabilities across the state, but because of outdated website designs, they've been unable to do simple things such as updating an address, changing to a married name, or registering to vote. Under the terms of a legal settlement reached last week, those agencies must now start making their websites accessible to those who are blind or visually impaired. Susan Dua, who heads the Center for Independence of the Disabled New York, or SIDNY, says the sites had violated the Americans with Disabilities Act.
By not allowing people to handle their voting information, which includes confidential information, privately and independently, the Board of Elections has been discouraging people from voting.
The agencies will have until the end of this year to bring their websites into full compliance with web content accessibility guidelines.
The lawsuit against the State Board of Elections was filed by SIDNY in conjunction with the National Federation for the Blind and two individual plaintiffs. I'm Mike Clifford. Thanks for starting your week, News and Cruisin' with Public News Service. We are member and listener supported, and we're online at publicnewsservice.org.
Grassroots groups like the Sunrise Movement and 350.org are mobilizing across California and the nation this week and next to promote the Green New Deal, a 10-year plan to fight climate change by weaning the country off of oil and gas. On Thursday, Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and Senator Ed Markey of Massachusetts introduced twin resolutions in the U.S. House and Senate. Masada Diesenhaus with the group San Diego 350 says the U.S. and the whole world need to work toward net zero greenhouse gas emissions and fast.
The vision of the Green New Deal is really a massive program of public investment aimed at transforming the energy sector and the whole economy to create clean energy jobs and infrastructure, to decarbonize the economy, and to promote economic justice.
The Green New Deal calls for the U.S. to switch over to a national smart grid that relies on renewable energy sources like solar and wind. It asks government and private businesses to retrofit buildings for energy efficiency and for job retraining for people working in the fossil fuel field. Opponents argue that the policies would cost too much and be disruptive to industry. Green groups are asking for a state-level plan to phase out drilling in the Golden State. But Diesenhaus thinks the real potential is in the transportation sector because in Southern California, vehicles produce almost half of the emissions.
That will have to change, and that can be through combined efforts to increase transit, have more active transportation like walking and biking, and electrifying vehicles.
The Green New Deal also emphasizes environmental justice. Its backers point out that lower-income communities have been disproportionately harmed by pollution from drilling and refineries and by the floods and wildfires linked to climate change. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. The issue of equal pay for equal work is front and center in Congress this week as House Democrats reintroduced the Paycheck Fairness Act. It comes exactly 10 years after President Barack Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, which modernized and improved on the Equal Pay Act of 1963. Nancy Marr with the American Association of University Women in California notes that it would prohibit employers from lowballing the salaries of job applicants based on what they made at their last job, which would ultimately improve wages for women.
A woman is given a salary based on the salary she earned previously, regardless of her merit or of the current pay scale within a given organization.
The act would also protect against retaliation for discussing pay with colleagues, and it would also require the feds to collect and publicize wage data. Right now, white women working full-time are paid on average 80 cents for every dollar paid to a man. Marr says women of color have it even worse, with black women making only 58 cents and Latina women 53 cents to a man's dollar.
Latinos are suffering the most with this. We hope that this will give a little bit more incentive for women to feel safer speaking up for their rights in terms of equal pay.
According to the Institute for Women's Policy Research, 2.5 million children would be lifted out of poverty, and the poverty rate for working single mothers would be cut in half if the gender pay gap was closed. At the current rate, it's expected to take another 40 years for women to achieve pay equity. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. Dear listeners, if you love trains, and who doesn't? This conversation is for you. My guest today is Richard Pennick of the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum Association. He was a former president and CEO, now the media coordinator, and a founding member of that 52-year-old organization. Dick Pennick, welcome.
Thank you very much, Helen. I'm pleased to be here.
Dick, you and your wife have lived in Casa de Oro for nearly 50 years. You are so steeped in East County history, we could start our conversation almost anywhere. But we're going to focus on the Railway Museum. It is impressive. Tell us where it is. Describe the size of the operation.
Thank you for asking. We like to facetiously tell some of our visitors that we're the best-kept secret in San Diego and want to keep it that way. There are still many, many thousands of people, I'm sure, that have not heard of us. And we began in the spring of 1961, right in San Diego. And even at that time, we were not the only railway history organization in town. There was an earlier one called Railway Historical Society of San Diego. And I like to think that the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum was an outgrowth of that early pioneer effort that began in the mid-1950s here. It was always the mission and the dream of Pacific Southwest Railway Museum to not only collect artifacts that represented the history and heritage of railroads, particularly in San Diego and the Pacific Southwest, but also have an opportunity to operate those items as an extension of our interpretive activities of the museum. And it took us a few years to get to the point where we could actually run something for the public, and certainly our initial efforts there were very crude. They were downtown on industrial rail spurs, all of which that are gone now.
So you truly were the heir to that. If you were downtown, you were saying downtown San Diego. But you are a nonprofit organization.
We are a nonprofit, 501c3, and probably one of the real turning points of the our organization was 1980, when we finally had an opportunity, after searching for many years, to find a site that we could construct a public railway museum and actually have an opportunity to run trains. And that occurred when we bought the property that we currently own at Campo. Initially, it was very small, 8 acres, and it has grown just in the last year to over 40 acres.
Wow.
We operate trains on a regular weekend schedule, generally weekends only. We do have a lot of charter opportunities, but we have amassed more than 100 items of historic railway rolling stock and other artifacts.
Now, in fact, aren't you operating 4 different entities under the umbrella?
We are. And at the risk of boring some of our visitors, we like to explain that certainly the Campo Living History and Train Operations Center, which we call the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, is our principal component, but we also own and operate and restored the original La Mesa Railway Station, which we call the 1894 La Mesa Depot Museum, and the portion of the San Diego and Arizona Eastern Railway that we operate our trains on each weekend. We have reacquired officially the original corporate name of the railroad, which was San Diego and Arizona Railway, when Spreckles built it in the early part of the last century.
And Spreckles is the sugar baron John Spreckles, who figures so prominently in early San Diego.
Yes, and
history.
Of course his family got their initial wealth in the sugar business in Hawaii. And they were located in San Francisco primarily in the 1880s and 1890s. And by a fluke of good luck for the city of San Diego, and certainly for us, they relocated John Spreckles and his brother Adolf relocated to San Diego. And it took off. He owned the local newspaper, the waterworks, the trolley operation, and built the railroad that we operate our trains on.
So that leads us to the question, how does the ownership of the railroad track actually work? We're all used to seeing trolleys going back and forth.
Right. The railroad was owned initially by the Spreckles family. They had a majority ownership, although not 100% ownership. There was a minority stock ownership by the Harriman, Edward H. Harriman interests, until Mr. Harriman died about 1906. And just before John began to construct the San Diego and Arizona Railway. And so the Spreckles family had to make a decision whether they were going to try to go it alone without Mr. Harriman's financial help or give up the project. They elected to go ahead, and it took them 12 years to build the railroad to a connection at El Centro with all the other railroads in the country. And when Spreckles died, his family continued to run the railroad without him for a while. They finally elected to sell their majority interest to the Southern Pacific Railroad. And then the Southern Pacific became sole owner at that point. So that gives you a little bit of the background. And then in 1979, the Southern Pacific Railroad sold almost the entire railroad, except for a 20-some mile segment in Imperial Valley, to what was at that time called the Metropolitan Transit Development Board, a board formed to explore and initiate construction of a local light rail transit.
Okay, better known as the Little Red Trolley.
Or the, the San Diego Trolley. That organization has morphed from Metropolitan Transit Development Board to what they now call Metropolitan Transit System.
That's about 44 miles of track, is that correct? Or 44 miles is in Mexico, going back to your earlier comment.
Right.
On the U.S. side of the border, it's MTS, or Metropolitan Transit District.
That's correct. And interestingly, Metropolitan Transit Development Board, as it was called in that time, did not really want the portion of the railroad that wound through Mexico and went out through the mountains of East County, where the museum currently operates its trains. They did not want that. But the Southern Pacific says it's all or nothing, and they had to take it all. So what they've done over the years is convert all of the trackage from San Ysidro to San Diego and El Cajon to a light rail transit system.
So this really is the story of train tracks in the modern age, when everything is cars and freeways and chewed up. And yet the interesting thing is the track that runs out to East County from San Diego is the same federal track, is it not?
It's the same railroad, and major changes have been made, not so much in location, but it occupies the original right-of-way of the original railroad and some of the predecessor railroads in San Diego, in on the San Diego end, and they have a freight contractor that runs the freight trains in the evening. And then, as you said
earlier... Is that the train whistle in the night?
That is the train whistle in the night, the midnight train whistle. 44 miles of the track, when it was being built, were located on the Mexican side of the border between Tijuana and 8 miles east of Tecate, Baja California, for construction feasibility purposes. That portion is currently owned by the Mexican government, operated by the Mexican government.
Okay.
Its name, when Spreckles owned it, was the Tijuana and Tecate Railway. It's now called Via Corta Tijuana-Tecate, which is Tijuana-Tecate short line. Once it crosses the border east of Tecate and goes back on the U.S. side, then it's Metropolitan Transit System ownership again, all the way out to Plaster City.
So
and we operate on 14 miles of that in the Campo area.
There are deep and irrevocable ties, transportation-wise, with our sister Mexico. Dick, you have very, very beautiful vintage trains. Do movie and television companies utilize this resource?
Oh, absolutely. And we have made it a point, for obvious reasons, to make sure that the movie industry knows who we are, where we are, and what we have to offer in the way of filming opportunities. And that is not just for feature films, but also for videos, for commercials, for fashion shoots. So we've done it all. Some of the films that we've been involved in, I won't list them all, the list is long, but MacArthur in 1976 was filmed downtown before we acquired the Campo property. And of course, the There Goes a Train video, which so many of our family visitors refer to, we first found out about you folks, and There Goes the Train. Somewhat more recently, Pearl Harbor, the year 2000, was filmed in part there. Just in the last year, we've had film crews from the Lone Ranger movie and also Saving Mr. Banks at our Campo site.
Richard, I know you have to dash back to the museum, but let's continue our conversation soon. We want to hearken back to the sound of train whistles in the night. I thank you for being here. I look forward to next time. For the Sounds of History, I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Working hard to bring you the wildest jobs in East County. Today, Cody and I went to Lakeside. There we met a man who's going to explain why his workday is more interesting than yours, or at least more likely to end up in a trip, to the hospital. I'm here today with Kevin Higley, who is a rodeo clown. Kevin, how long have you been doing rodeo clowning?
Ooh, that's a dated question, huh? You're going to make me tell how old I am is what you're trying to get at, right? No, I've been actually a professional rodeo clown for 30 years. Prior to that, I participated in high school rodeo and as a contestant, and then I started doing what we call amateur rodeos as a rodeo clown bullfighter, and then I got my pro card and went on to the professional ranks, and so I've been it for, I bet you, total almost 35 years.
So you were doing professional rodeo as what, prior to doing the clown part of it?
I was, I tried to be a bull rider, thought maybe I could make a profession out of it and a living. Wasn't very good at that. So what it came to be was my brother was a really good bull rider, and we had what they call a practice pen at home where we buck some bulls and stuff, and so we took turns being the bullfighter who would save the bull rider. Well, boy, I saved him a whole lot more than he ever thought of saving me. And so it became apparent that I was probably a little bit more adapted to the bullfighting area and saving the cowboys. And that was really the love and passion that I had once I got started, that, you know, the thrill of saving a guy so you can get on to another one is really something else. And as time went on, of course, you slow down a couple steps. Not me, but my mind may. I don't know. But anyway, so then I transferred into the rodeo clown / barrel man type aspect of the professional rodeo deal.
Now, you use the term bull fighting, which seems more appropriate to me somehow. So here's another question for you. I've noticed that bulls don't seem to have a lot of sense of humor. So have you actually made one ever laugh?
Oh, yeah, they're always smiling when they run over you. Yeah, well, they've got a smile. You know, a lot of people, they used to say that a bull will actually close his eyes before he runs over you. But that's not true. I can attest to that. They're wide open, and they are laughing. It's like, I got you, buddy. It's good.
So the natural follow-up to that is, how many bones have you had broken?
That's one we don't like to discuss very much. But, you know, I've been really fortunate in my career to stay away from most of the broken bones. I fractured a couple neck vertebrae, and I've had a couple of bones in my foot broke and a couple of things like that. But as a whole, I've been really healthy and really good.
Do you really like to use the word whole when you're talking about bulls and horns and stuff like that?
Yeah, that's kind of, you got to watch that one. Put you in a hole.
Now, I'm sure that people, not necessarily associated with rodeo, but people on the outside probably think that you would do this for the thrills. What kind of satisfaction do you get from actually doing this work?
That's a great question. You know, like I said, early on, is just the satisfaction that you've did something to help somebody else to be able to further their career and go on and stuff. So saving a bull rider from a bull or helping him, assisting him to be a higher score, that's where it starts. And that now it's the thrill of entertainment, you know, making people laugh. I just love to hear them giggle and laugh. And so that part is where I'm at now in my career. So we do it for the love, because, you know, unlike a lot of professional sports, the money isn't probably as as good as your football, your baseball, your basketball players, but it also is an aspect of it. We do it for the money as well.
Yeah, so you're as a professional rodeo, I see that you have a big trailer, so you travel around from rodeo to rodeo?
I do. Throughout the course of this year, I'll probably be in at least 15 states. I guess the farthest away, which my trailer wasn't able to go with me and a lot of my animals wasn't, was Hawaii. We've actually did rodeos in Hawaii on two of the islands over there.
Oh, really? So you did go to Hawaii, but you just didn't float your trailer across?
No, trailer stayed home as well as my animals that I use in my clown acts, yeah.
Okay, so you do an act out on the in the arena with your own animals. I see you have a dog over there. Is that one of your...
Yeah, I've actually got three or four dogs, and I've got a trick horse, trick mule. You know, sometimes the kids become my tricks. You know, I'm very enthusiastic about getting the crowd involved, and so we use the kids a lot of times in some of the things we do.
If I ever were to find myself in a field with a pissed-off bull, because, you know, that happens to me a lot. Give me some ideas for how to sort of distract the guy.
Well, so the best thing to do is, of course, it's not all about how fast you can outrun them. It's about the move that you can make to get around them. Because they've got a big old body and they got to bend and have to get to back to where you are. So what you want to do is you want to kind of get in as close as possible and then make that move to the inside and keep them coming. And then when you get the break, you break them so they're on a different lead and you can get away from them.
So you have to fight every instinct, natural instinct, to turn around and run. You have to get close to them, right next to them, in order to be safe.
You're sure better off. Yeah, you're better off. I mean, I know that my legs have never stood around for my face to take a beating, you know. And so it's kind of a natural instinct to run, yes. But, you know, there's a lot of different things you use. The apparel that we wear, the things we wear that gets their attention, that will bring them in your direction, and then it's up to you to make the move to bring them away from the cowboy and to get yourself away.
Okay. Now, professional football players, you mentioned them. They're always complaining about having a short career. Now, you've been doing this for a while. How long would you say the average rodeo clown sort of stays in the profession?
You know, and I guess that would be a term that's kind of tough to use, average, because I don't know any of us that are too, you know. And I guess the guy that kind of I look up to and kind of was my mentor, taught me a little bit, was a guy by the name of Wick Path. And he actually fought bulls at an active level, professional level, till he was 57 years old. It's all about how physically fit you stay. We've got a guy in the business right now that's strictly entertainment. He doesn't even get in the barrel anymore or do any of those things to help out. And he's 78 years old and very active and doing a great job.
Okay, well, see, my son here is, let's say that he goes to see his guidance counselor at school, and the guidance counselor, I've noticed, is, doesn't have any posters on the wall of rodeos or anything.
No.
But let's say that she says that she's changed her mind and he should forget about engineering and all of that, and he should become a rodeo clown. What advice would you give him for getting into this job, apart from why don't you do something safe like join the Navy SEALs?
Yeah, there we go. Two safe jobs. Well, I'll tell you what the first thing I would do with modern day rodeo, we have schools, and the best thing to do for someone that's inspiring to be a rodeo clown or a bullfighter or a participant, a contestant, is to search out one of those schools and go spend a week, 3 days, whatever the school is, and actually get a head start on what they really could do and if they're adapted for that.
Do you know of any women who do this job who are rodeo clowns?
You know, there used to be, years ago, there was a lady that actually didn't actually do the bullfighting part of the clown, but she got in the barrel and she would tell a few jokes and do stuff. But that was a long time ago. Right at this present time, I don't know anybody, any ladies. I think it has to do with intelligence.
Oh, okay. That's an excellent point. Cody, you have a question?
Yeah, what's the deal with the barrels? What exactly do you do with barrels?
Okay, the barrel is out there for a particular reason. We had put it out in the middle of the arena, actually not quite the middle of the arena, it's a little closer to the bucking shoes, and it really becomes kind of like a safe haven for the bullfighters or the bull riders case that bull is coming at them, they're caught out in no man's land, they can come there, catch the breath, get away, or at least the bull will be distracted so they can move on. It's my job as a barrel man to position my barrel in a place which will help assist the bullfighters and the bull rider to be able to have a little bit more safety. So, and it's really like sitting in a washing machine just waiting for somebody to turn that thing on, the spin cycle. Because when one of those guys hits it, it can really turn your world upside down.
So it sounds like your job is more about strategy than it is about, I mean, obviously on YouTube or on TV, what they like to show is rodeo clowns being tossed and trampled and all that. But the object is to avoid that and to protect the cowboys and to entertain the crowd, basically, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a given that you're going to be in a very bad situation most of the time because, you know, you've got an unpredictable animal. He's going to do what he wants to do. He's going to do his. So you're going to be put in a position where you're going to get in there that you're probably going to get what they call hooked and thrown out of there. But the better that you prepare yourself to be able to make yourself in the right position to walk away from that, the longer your career will be.
So you're kind of like the ninjas of the West, is what you're telling me.
I've never had it put that way, but yeah, cowabunga, dude, let's do it.
Okay, Cody.
So is it true about bulls that they don't like red, like don't like red capes? Is that true?
Great question. You know, and it really is a myth. It doesn't have to do with the red cape that the matadors you see if the matadors are fighting, or like in our case, we wear bandanas a lot of times on our deals. It's all about the movement. It's the movement of something that brings their attention to it. And that's why when you see the guys with the capes and the matadors, and they can stand in one spot, but the bull will follow a cape and follow that deal.
Is there anything else you'd like to say to the people of East County?
Boy golly, if they get a chance, come to the rodeo. They're going to enjoy it.
So, Cody, now that you've seen a little bit of what life as a rodeo clown is like, are you ready to reconsider your future?
No, because as much as my counselors say that I should quit any field that involves thinking, I think I should steer clear of this kind of career.
Are you saying that you don't want to get involved in something that can cow you this much?
You know, I have a lot of beef with you saying something that mean about me, Dad.
Well, I would say that right now my attitude is the lasso your problems.
I just don't know if I'm capable of learning the ropes on this exciting career.
Well, son, that sounds like a lot of bull to me because I don't know anyone who clowns around as much as you do. This is Mark Clements.
And this is Cody Clements.
Clocking out of one of the wildest jobs in East County.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests. This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.